You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at the 2022 Vuelta España, powered by Super Sapiens, energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Today we're on the Alto de Piornal.
Hello, buenas tardes from La Vuelta a España. My name is Daniel Freiba. I am the host of tonight's episode. And as you heard our friend Rob Hatch just say, I am on, I think he said on, the Alto del Piornal, high above the Valle Cereza, or Cherry Valley. More about that in a moment, once I've introduced one of our guests. Now, in fact, multiple guests tonight. In fact, it's a packed show. Lots of people appearing on the podcast tonight, so let's get to it. Joining me today from Villefranche-sur-Mer, basically Monaco for a fraction of the price, but several multiples of the tax, it's current AG2R Citroën professional, veteran of four Vueltas a España, also Tour de Suisse stage winner, 2017 US National Road Race champion. He is Michigan's only true sporting icon, a man that makes Irvin Magic Johnson look like a $50 an hour kids entertainer with tricks from a Christmas cracker. He is not afraid to call a spade, a mystifying slow puncture. It's Lucky Larry Warbass.
Hey guys, good to be here.
Guys, well, we'll get the second guest in a minute. Larry, anything to say from the outset tonight? Any apologies to issue to the nation of Belgium?
Not at all. No, I didn't run into any issues, so that's good.
I no think hate
luckily,
mail from your teammate.
Not too many Belgians listen to the podcast, so that's good.
Okay, let's keep it that way. Also joining us tonight from Soya in Mallorca, long-serving Eurosport cycling commentator, the multilingual voice of cycling, and owner of multiple voices, depending on whether he's commentating, podcasting, or belting out Sting's greatest hits in the shower. Yes, he really does do that, I can confirm. It's Accrington Cricket Club's Tutankhamun of Trundle, a rabbit with numerous habits about which I could regale you with numerous stories as his former flatmate. It's Rob Hatch.
With every breath you'll take, that is getting even better every single day. Wow, what an intro. I think you've won the podcast awards already.
Well, as explained to Brian Nygaard yesterday, in the absence of Primoz Roglic, in the absence of any great suspense about who's going to win this Vuelta a España, and my aim is to make this podcast 95% intros and 5% other content. So we're doing pretty well so far. However, today was exciting, wasn't it, chaps? It was a bit of a barnstormer of a stage, wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, I don't know. That was pretty cool. It was nice to see like full gas racing from start to finish today.
An absolutely tremendous stage. And I think the thing to underline from me straight away was the belief still, because you've had these people, even yourself, Daniel, at times doubting Remco Evenepoel. Can he last? Can he do it?
Hang on.
Because we're all on a voyage of discovery. I'm
the voice of reason and diplomacy. It's the guests that say that come out with these controversial statements and allegations.
I was trying to maybe save someone's skin over in Denmark.
When I saw his performance today, I thought about you, Daniel. Just, you know, your blood in the water. And so maybe you need to make an apology to the nation of Belgium. I don't know.
Well, okay, let's get to apologies or challenge. I'm going to challenge you now, Larry. It's not about the Vuelta a España. Before we get onto the serious business, today we're in a place called, Alto del Piornal. Today I discovered that as I said in the intro, it's in a valley or overlooks the Cherry Valley, in effect. And of course, this ties back to Traverse City. I've pronounced that wrong as well. Remind us,
exactly.
Traverse City.
Which
you claimed the other day was the world capital of cherries. However, I think Piornal has a very convincing case to make. And 1 to 2 million kilos of cherries produced every year here. They have a Fiesta del Cerezo. Or en Flor, the party of the or fiesta of the cherry trees in bloom. What's the competition? The cherry pit spitting competition?
Cherry pit spitting contest.
Yeah. None of that, unfortunately. But
obviously not the world capital of cherries. Then they don't even know the game.
You're standing by your story on that front. Well, talking of stories. talking of stories, we are going to get in a minute to the stage summary time trial. However, this morning in Trujillo, I mentioned yesterday that I was looking forward to seeing the Plaza Mayor. I'm not sure if it's called the Plaza Mayor, the main square anyway, which is a beautiful, well, it's not a square, it's more of a circle. And I likened it yesterday to the Piazza del Campo in Siena, really one of the most impressive squares in Spain. But we didn't get to see it because the team buses were down the bottom of the hill. However, there was a lot of talk today, obviously, about what might happen in the stage. And, well, following on from last night's podcast, in which we somehow cobbled together, conjured up some kind of convincing hypothesis about UAE Team Emirates and what they would do today, and perhaps Joao Almeida even winning the Vuelta a España. Following on from that, we made a beeline for Juan Ayuso, who, of course, started the day in third place on general classification. And this is what he said about what they were planning today.
I think now the decisive days have started in the last week. For sure, it's going to be hard. Yesterday already in a climb that wasn't super tough, we went full gas. So today, which is much harder, I think it's going to be a brutal battle. Of course, I'm ambitious, and of course, I would love to be first or second. But you also have to be realistic, no? And you have to know that the time gaps in front of me are much bigger than the ones behind me, no? The ones that are trying to take the podium off me are just 30 seconds behind me, which is not much, no? So, of course, you race to win, but also at this stage, you have to be realistic, and yeah, and more try to defend my podium. Team with me is something vital for to manage to be in the first places in the race. So yeah, I hope the team really helps me. That's the intention, and we'll give our best.
You're also the team with two cards to play, and you and Almeida. Can you use that for anything?
Yeah, for sure. You'll see.
Do you have plans?
Yeah, I guess so.
Juan, can I just ask about the significance of that necklace?
Yeah. Oh, this was when I was born. My grandmother, it was a gift from my grandmother, and it always stays with me.
So, chaps, that sounded like a battle cry, and what we got from UAE was, well, it was pretty aggressive. It was inventive. They looked as though they used their resources pretty well. There was no real sign, I don't think, maybe you chaps will disagree, of this friction we've been hearing about between Juan Ayuso and Joao Almeida. I thought they rode fairly harmoniously today. But the Almeida attack was certainly one feature of the stage. And, well, let's hear about what else happened today. Larry, you're the man with the aerofoil helmet. You have taken on the responsibility of doing the
El resumen del día a contrarreloj. The stage summary time trial.
Well, Larry, I have my stopwatch in front of me. You have acquitted yourself extremely well so far in this Vuelta a España with these 90-second time trials. Can you do it again today? It's a tough one. It might be the toughest one of the Vuelta. A lot to pack in. If you don't name every single person that was in a break today, frankly, I will be disappointed. I'm going to count you in. Larry Warbass, you have 3, 2, 1. Off you go.
Okay, so today was stage 18 from Trujillo to Alto del Piornal. It was 192 kilometers, and Remco Evenepoel, the red jersey, won the stage 2 seconds ahead of Enric Mas, and third was Robert Gesink out of the breakaway, or Hesink. Evenepoel still has the red jersey, 207 ahead of Enric Mas, and 514 ahead of Juan Ayuso. But yeah, I would say the day was marked. There was a really big breakaway, 43 men on the attack. But I would say sort of like the most exciting thing of the day was a long-range attack by Almeida, who tried to, yeah, pull some time back on the GC guys, but unfortunately in the end was unsuccessful. He was launched by his teammate Brandon McNulty. Some other teammates waited and paced him, but in the end he was caught on the final climb by the leaders behind, and that is exactly, how we ended up with that podium today. And now the KOM is Richard Carapaz, because there was a big crash at the start that took out Jay Vine and his hopes to win the KOM jersey, which is too bad. He'll miss out on a bit of prize money there.
More about that later.
Yeah, Carlos Rodriguez also was in the crash, which maybe affected him. He lost a little bit of time and fell from, one position in GC. But yeah, that's pretty much everything. Oh, Mads Pedersen's still in the sprint jersey, but we knew that, so.
Right on the money, right on the dollar again, Larry. Fairly, as was the case yesterday with Brian Nygaard, painted in fairly impressionistic broad brushstrokes there, but we'll forgive you that. Did a pretty good job. It was a tall order today. Anything to add, Rob Hatch? You've got the commentator's eye as well as the commentator's voice. Anything Larry missed out?
Really difficult, actually, to follow the stage. I mean, just off a quick tangent. I mean, we go off a lot of tangents on the podcast, so why not another? When you're watching the stage on the telly, I was talking to my dad on the phone, and it's so much more difficult to pick up every little single thing when you can be doing other things and you're not sat in front of a telly and concentrating and having to pronounce on whatever's happening. So I think Larry did a tremendous job there. And
thank you.
I mean, once we got into the end there, it was almost the least expected day, wasn't it, for Movistar? But in the final 300 metres, it was the most expected winner, wasn't it, with Remco Evenepoel. Evenepoel and Mas, the party poopers there for Robert Huizing, who almost pulled off what I think would have been one of the most popular wins of this Welter Gents. I think he's a popular guy, isn't he, Robert Huizing?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I think he definitely is. Sorry, I forgot that Larry then was the authority on.
Oh no, you can tell me what you think, but yeah.
No, I mean, it was no. Honestly, Larry, it was something that I was looking forward to. Well, I was looking forward to seeing Robert Huizing win because it was one of these. It would have been one of these great sort of swan song victories. I'm not sure actually. Maybe you chaps know how long Robert Huizing intends to carry on his career. I think he's 35 or 36 now, but I haven't heard anything to the effect that next year is going to be his last year or the year after. But it would have been one of those, well, we're talking about cherries, it would have been the sort of cherry on the icing of the cake of Robert Huizing's career, wouldn't it? And I think a victory that a lot of people would have been happy about. I mean, I was waiting to speak to Theo Gegenhardt at the finish and didn't manage to, but that was in the anticipation of Huizing winning, because I know that Theo and Robert Huizing train a lot together.
I mean, Robert Huizing's 36 now, Daniel. He is going to ride next year for Jumbo-Visma. We don't know anything beyond that. And for people who might have come to the sport in the last few years, it's probably worth reminding everybody that this was a guy who was the big hope of Dutch cycling, wasn't he? He was going for GC prizes. He was trying to win big races. He's been in the top five on GC at the Tour de France. He's won the Tour of California 10 years ago. He's won the Tour of Oman as well. He's won both of the big one-day races in Canada as well. So back when he was trying to win for himself, he was got a fairly decent palmarès, and also a Grand Tour stage winner at the Welter, although not on Spanish soil. He won on a French mountain, on a Tour mountain, when the Welter went to the Obis. So he's got a, for a helper, he's got a tremendous palmarès. We're not talking about, you know, Peter Seri, with all respect due to him, another tremendous bike rider who maybe earlier in his career decided that he wasn't going to go for the big prize himself.
Just alienate a few more Belgians.
I'm a huge Peter Seri fan because of the quite mature decision that he took to try and concentrate on being a helper, because he was a talented guy and followed by a lot of Belgian television cameras very, very early on in his career. I think there was even a reality TV documentary made about Peter Seri in his first year.
How did I miss that?
probably on Flemish television. But yeah, I think Robert Huizing has a tremendous palmarès, and we often forget, I think, what he's won when we see him riding. So just proves that he's still got it.
I'm also always reminded whenever someone, which nowadays occurs relatively frequently, a young rider signs a 5 or 6 or 7 year contract. I think have we seen 7 year contracts maybe? But this is certainly a new phenomenon, or a recent phenomenon in the last 3 or 4 years. We've seen these very long contracts in professional cycling. Huizing signed a 5 year contract. I think it was in 2005 or 2006 or 2007, around about that time. Basically his first contract or his second contract for Rabobank. They believed in him that much that they gave him a 5 year contract, which was very unusual. It might even have been unprecedented then. Chaps, just looking at the GC for a day when an awful lot happened, there weren't that many changes in the sense that there were a few guys who moved up one place. Superman Lopez leapfrogged Sugarman Rodriguez. But otherwise, you have to go down a long way, down to 21st place, David de la Cruz, who lost 7 places on the GC. But otherwise, it was people gaining 1, losing 1, gaining 3. So not the sort of revolution that we maybe expected on general classification. Larry, before we hear from we hear from Robert Huizing and a few others from the finish line today, I just wanted to get your view on how your team and your teammate, Ben O'Connor, Ben Superbok O'Connor, how they rode today.
you know, I know that he wasn't exactly content with how his day went, but you know, I think Ben has like his own unique sort of style of riding, and you know, he gets he's a little bit of a stressor. So I think that makes him attack earlier than normal or attack more often than some other guys, rather than like, you know, you see some other guys who are super calm and calculated and wait for like, you know, maybe the perfect moment or whatever. But to be honest, I know, like, I think that style of racing has led Ben to become the rider he is, because like, he isn't the guy who always waits and, you know, so maybe he can be from time to time overly aggressive, but, yeah, I would say a lot of times it's paid off. So today it didn't pay off, but, you know, he didn't really lose any time, so hardly, not to the guys around him. So I think, yeah, you know, he did what he had to do, but I think, you know, he might be disappointed he couldn't go for the stage win, but it looked pretty hard to beat Remco on that last climb.
Well, chaps, as promised, let's hear from Robert Heysink. Then from João Almeida, who, as we said, was the main protagonist, really, of what looked as though it was going to be the only move, really, that looked as though it had the potential to completely turn things around on GC. And then finally, let's hear from Ben O'Connor, and let's hear what he made of his own performance.
Happy is not really the right word, I guess, but I was happy to be in the break, and I was happy until the last 200 meters, but yeah, not so happy after that. Well, yeah, you win some, you lose some. I was happy we could reset the team, reset our spirits, our mindset. We all came here to win with Primoz, and yesterday was a tough day, therefore, and I think today we showed that we had the legs to do something nice with the team, with him. Unfortunately, it was a great day until 200 meters to go. Oh, yeah, Grisha kept me posted, and I actually never looked back until I looked back at one moment and I saw a front wheel coming, and then I knew that... So it's going to be really difficult. Well, I did make it in the winner's picture. So 3 years ago, I changed my style of riding and my work, my training, everything to support our GC men. And then to change back, I wasn't sure I could do it. So actually, I guess I'm quite happy to know that I can change back and ride for myself once again. And unfortunately, there were two slightly better today. So yeah, that was tough to see. And it's also kind of nice to ride for victory again. I'm not going to say I'm the happiest man on the earth right now.
Robert, it looked like one of those where maybe your feelings sort of fluctuated throughout the day. It looked like there were moments where you felt really good, moments when you were struggling a bit more.
I'm kind of a diesel, so if they go real fast in the beginning, I'm always struggling, and I know that. I've been doing this quite some time now. But I know I'm always at the same pace also towards the end, so if I would have been another climb, I could have done it at the same pace, I think. No, just kidding.
Yeah, we tried to put the pressure on. We found a good moment, and we gave everything we had, and I think we did some damage. I mean, I was hoping to, yeah, maybe have a little bit more room, more time. But yeah, I also would know that they would not let me go very far. We tried everything, so we were ahead. We did it perfect like we thought, so we can be proud of ourselves.
It wasn't up to us to ride, but yeah, it was good, actually. It was good racing today. I'm a bit pissed off, to be honest, because I think I rode a bit stupid today, and I think I could have fought for the win today, so I'm not really so happy, to be honest. I thought there'd be a couple more teammates to ride real hard and make it a bit more solid, but in the end it was a bit tactical at the end, but I should have waited and kept my bullets dry because I spent way too many. It was nice to have a fun stage where it's a bit chaotic because every other day has been a bit too simple for me.
The Cycling Podcast at the 2022 Vuelta España, powered by Super Sapiens. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Still guessing on fueling? Not sure what or when to eat and drink on rides that matter? Never again. Optimize your fueling strategy with real-time glucose data, actionable insights, and personalized analytics. We're here to help you achieve your performance goals. Go to supersapiens.com for more on how to track your energy levels and fuel for success.
Thank you very much to Super Sapiens, our title sponsors. Super Sapiens and the system of continuous glucose monitoring can help you fuel more effectively and efficiently for your event. It can help you learn about how your body responds to certain types of food, the time of day that you eat them, how your body responds to exercise, rest, and even stress. All professional athletes have to take particular care about their fueling strategy before, during, and after racing. And Sam Brand of Team Novo Nordisk has some golden rules, and this is the first one.
Probably most important is little and often, or not necessarily little, but often, you know, so making sure that I graze through food. There's times where you think you're not burning any energy because you're riding easy, but you know that's constant burning energy. Thinking is burning energy, so making sure that, number one, you stay on top of eating at regular intervals. It's all about, and probably, I guess, a second golden rule is don't change what you know. You know, sometimes you go to an event for people who are signed up to something and you get given, like, I don't know, a different brand of cereal bar, a different brand of energy drink or whatnot, but you might not be used to it. It's all about making sure that you've developed that sort of rapport with a brand, whether that's the brand that you use every day, but making sure that you know what you're putting in is something that is going to react well, so something that you've trained on.
To find out more about Super Sapiens, go to supersapiens.com.
El Diario Remco, The Daily Remco.
I just try to enjoy it as much as possible. I think that's the most important. It's my 12th day now as a leader, so that's quite a long period. So we are really close to the last day, so I just hope to take it home to wear the jersey for 3 more days. That would be, I think then it's perfect. A pretty tough and tricky climb, around 90k to go, so I expect the race will be quite open from there on, and then I expect a long final, but like I said, the final climb is not super hard, it's more about slipstream also, so I think it's gonna be a bit of a more open final, but I expect that we can go to the finish line with a small group, yeah.
Well, that was first another bit of canned Rob Hatch, and then our race leader and stage winner today, Remco Evenepoel, speaking this morning in Trujillo, talking about how he was intending to enjoy the rest of the Vuelta as much as possible. And then we heard him talk about this, what he called a long final, basically meaning that the race was going to come alive pretty early today. And I don't know how long that final, you know, you would define that final as being. It was probably an hour or so, wasn't it, Larry, when it was pretty much full gas racing before the kind of coup de grace, which Remco applied with that sprint to win on the Alto del Piornal.
Yeah, I mean, I'd even say it started a bit earlier with Almeida. You know, he teched pretty far out, and they had to go, you know, when they were keeping him within a minute for however many K it was, like 50K or even longer, that's not easy, because I'm sure he was going as hard as he could go, so they were going as hard as they could behind. And so I would say that was like, yeah, the whole last majority of the race could be considered, you know, ridden like a final, because I'm sure everyone was full gas in those groups.
Did you chaps notice that Almeida, did he launch his attack on the climb, or was it just before? Anyways, the Alto de la Desesperada, which, well, it doesn't quite mean the mountain of despair or the mountain of kind of hopelessness, but very nearly. And I suppose it looked like a bit of an optimistic move. But what do you chaps think of? I mean, Larry, how many times in races have you been in teams when they have tried this tactic of sending what we call satellite riders now down the road, and it's actually worked? Because I mean, these divide opinions, these moves, this tactic, because it is quite rare that the timing works out and the guy that you want to be down the road is where you want him to be. I mean, Marc Soler, I would suggest he's probably the perfect guy to have to pull in a valley or pull up a climb for, I don't know, 10 or 20 kilometers. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I was just getting reflections of the Movistar documentary when he was waiting, you know, and there was a moment where, like, Almeida was, like, yelling in the radio to be like, I'm right behind you or something, just as he was about to catch him. But yeah, I mean, I don't know, you know, I don't know if I've ever really been in a team that's like made some elaborate crazy plan like that. A lot of times you'll be like, hey, let's send some guys in the breakaway so that they can get an advance, you know, maybe help like the GC guy if they need. But I mean, whether it's like super effective or not, I think it's just, it's kind of cool to see, you know, like it's a pretty sweet plan, you know, like, I mean, it might be like a little bit extra and over the top, but I mean, you know, it can definitely help. Like, if you have really, you know, strong guys in between, it can definitely make a difference, you know? I mean, just having, you know, it was earlier, even today. I mean, okay, for example, it wasn't at the front of the race, but there was this point where Carlos Rodriguez got dropped, and then Ben Turner, like, you know, brought the group back on sort of a flat over the top of the climb. And, like, you know, so there are these sections where it really, really can help to have a teammate. If you're on a climb that's, like, of a decent steepness, I don't think it helps that much. But yeah, it's definitely doesn't hurt to have your teammates up the road. So I thought it was a cool tactic. And I mean, he was throwing a Hail Mary anyway. So it was just cool to see him try. And yeah, sorry for the American football reference. But, you know, I thought it was a good thing to watch. It was pretty cool.
This is something that a lot of the experts that I work with often allude to. I mean, I guess it could help, even if you can't pull anybody or give anybody a turn. If you're there to give a bead on, if you're there to give a wheel, if you have a puncture, helping the mechanical, surely that's worth the Hail Mary as well, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, definitely. But I think the thing is if you get a flat in that situation, you're pretty much done anyway. You know, like at that point, you might as well just wait for the car and give up. You do you know what I mean? Like if you don't have more than a minute and the car's not behind you, you're going to lose that much time just fiddling around with, you know, bikes and mechanical changes. So, yeah, any help that, like, a teammate can give is good. But I think in that situation, you know, you're really looking for, like, a guy who can pull on the valley in between. And you know, that can make a big difference. But, yeah, like, on an uphill, especially if it's steep, it's probably not going to make, like, a massive difference.
I mean, Almeida said they tried to do some damage, and they had managed to do some damage. I don't know whether there he was alluding to what's to come, and the fact that, as you say, Larry, it was probably 2 hours of intense racing, and there will be guys who will suffer in the next couple of days. You could argue that, well, if Carlos Rodriguez if he lost time today, which he did, and he drifted further away from Juan Ayuso, I mean, that was entirely due to the crash. And in fact, he did brilliantly, I thought, to ride or to get as close to Superman Lopez and Ayuso as he did. I think maybe the more difficult days for him are still to come. I mean, we discussed it, I think, already, Larry. Or no, that was actually with Dan Martin a few days ago. The issue of crashing and the worst day often being the second day after the crash. Is that your experience?
Yeah, it kind of depends on the crash, I guess. Like, I guess the difference is, I think sometimes it's worse if you're not riding. So, you know, like if you just totally stop, say you crash in a race and you stop the race, 2 days later is definitely worse. But I think that can also be because you're not moving, you know, like it's kind of like you just sit around and then, you know, you don't have the blood flow and doesn't get everything moving. Whereas like sometimes in the race, I feel like, right after you crash, surely it doesn't hurt, because you have all the adrenaline. But then like the day after can be bad, but then maybe 2 days later I feel like you're starting to get better because you're already getting like the blood flow and the recovery. So maybe I have a slightly different opinion, but we'll see. I guess tomorrow could be something interesting to watch, but it might not be like the craziest, hardest stage of the race, so he might be lucky.
Well, chaps, I did say a few days ago that there was blood in the water. And in fact, today we saw the shark himself circling at one point, didn't we? Or certainly trying to help Miguel Angel Lopez chase down Almeida, and doing a pretty decent job. They got him back eventually. But as far as Remco is concerned, well, whatever difficulty he had last weekend in Andalusia, it seems to be a distant memory now, because he looks back to, well, the form that he was in at the start of the Vuelta. He looks extremely fresh, he sounds extremely fresh, and it's very, very difficult now to see how he's not going to win this Vuelta a España. Would you agree?
I definitely agree, yeah. I mean, now he looks super strong, so maybe he showed a moment of faiblesse a couple, you know, days ago,
look at you bringing all the Villefranche-sur-Mer local vernacular. You know,
But yeah, nah, he looks super strong today. And the only thing that was like a little bit of a question was his team, because he was pretty thin on teammates for a while. But I think with all the other guys having teammates around and being close together on GC, that's going to save him.
I mean, I love the idea, chaps, of this on Saturday in the Sierra de Guadarrama. It has played host to lots of sort of fantastic finales in the Vuelta, penultimate stages in particular, where the Vuelta has been decided or turned on its head. And, you know, it's given rise to all these legendary stories about Vueltas of yore. I would love to think that we would have a fantastic day with, you know, people attacking from the first climb. There's a climb very early on Saturday. And we would have some suspense, and we would have moments where we think that maybe Enric Mas is going to turn this race on its head. I just can't see it. I mean, Mas put in a good attack on the final climb. It was an attack with conviction, and certainly in his words, in his interviews, he sounds like a man who's not resigned to second place. However, I just cannot see how he's going to dethrone Remco at this point. What do you think, Rob?
I think we're seeing an Enric Mas that we've not seen before in terms of his confidence, the way he's talking, as you've just alluded to. We know that Movistar have the strongest team when you certainly compare it to what they're up against in Quickstep Alpecin. Again, that's no disrespect to the Belgian team, but of course their numbers down. Movistar have all the experience.
Don't worry, Rob. We're going to upset a few more Belgians in just a minute. So
maybe I'm going to struggle to get the visa to get in for the next race next time the classics come around. But no, I think Remco Evenepoel's dealing with it fantastically well, and I think I was very much in the camp that you alluded to, the blood in the water camp. I had a conversation with a couple of colleagues, and you know, I thought that Roglic was going to do the deed and turn it around. But I'm not sure that Enric Mas can. I know he will try. Movistar have to try, surely. I mean, again, they're in this fantastic, fantastic position in the Vuelta, just like they were 12 months ago. But we saw how it unraveled with Superman and everything like that. Mas is their man. He has the people to work for him. A strong Verona, a Valverde who's not looking as strong as perhaps we've seen him. But remember, it's his last ever mountain stage of a Grand Tour on Saturday. Surely, if there is something to be dug deep and found, he will find it. And they've got to try, haven't they? They're trying to stay up. They're in that final relegation place. They're bottom of the league at the minute.
Yeah, I don't know. I was going to say, to me, that's the one thing that's going to keep them from doing anything crazy, is because they really, really need Mas to get these points. You know, like, Mas will save Movistar from getting relegated with his second place. And to me, like, that's just like a risk, you know, like, they're not, I don't think they're gonna like be willing to take is to give up, like, you know, like do something so crazy to try to win the Vuelta, but risk losing second place, because they really, really need this second place. So, I don't know. I just worry that that's going to kind of like, hamper the, aggressiveness.
There'll be no Hail Mary.
No.
There'll be no Hail Mary or even Ave Maria from them, I don't think, will there? Chaps, I said we're going to upset a few more Belgians. Actually, I'm not going to take responsibility for this. This information comes from a Belgian colleague, so this is sort of this is self-harm, patriotic self-harm from Jan-Pieter de Vlieger of Het Nieuwsblad. I believe he spent yesterday with Remco's parents. They are here on the Vuelta a España. They tend to park at the bottom of the final climb every day and walk up to the top, but they are having a great time, a great holiday. And I think this was in Het Nieuwsblad this morning. If not, it will be in the next couple of days. Apparently, Remco was texting Wout van Aert congratulations at regular intervals during the Tour de France, and he never got a reply. This is according to Remco's parents. Remco hasn't had a single text from Wout van Aert during the Vuelta. And what do you make of that?
Maybe they're thinking about what happened in the World Championships last year. Just a little bit of speculation.
Maybe he just thinks it's spam, you know? he just deleted the number and he thinks it's spam.
Straight to his junk messages.
Yeah.
I think we need more information. We need to go more forensic on this. I'd like to know whether Wout van Aert even blue-ticked him during the Tour de France.
Yeah.
That would be
maybe
a real,
he has
that
the blue ticks turned off. He seems like the kind of guy who might not leave that on.
So all seriousness, today was another huge step forward, wasn't it, for Remco Evenepoel? Probably the biggest in his career, I'd say. Winning a big uphill finish of a Grand Tour for the first time. He's had a couple of those this year. Of course, he won Liège. He took the red jersey in that first Grand Tour station. But I would say that today's probably the biggest day of his career.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, just on the course and the absence of Primoz Roglic, driving up these final climbs both yesterday and today, you couldn't help feeling that they were perfect for Roglification, and they would have suited him down to the ground.
I feel like today, that's what I thought about. I was like, wow, okay, even if Roglic was here, I think he would have crushed, I think Remco would have crushed him. Like, when you saw him attack, like full sprint, you know? I don't know, to me, it really impressed me. Yeah. So. I don't know. When I watched today, I was just like, wow, I don't think even Roglic could have beaten him, you know? But yeah, you keep going. Sorry.
I mean, I just thought based on the way that Roglic attacked in Tomares on, when was that? That was Tuesday. It looked like vintage Roglic. And yesterday, had we had vintage Roglic, I thought that possibly he could have put some daylight between himself and the other favourites and got a time bonus. Potentially, if the team had ridden for that. And then today again, as it happened, everything came back together and he could possibly have got another time bonus today. But, you know, if my aunt had wheels, she would be a wheelbarrow, as the Italians say. Chaps, in a change to the normal running of things and the advertised programme of events, we're going to have the Encuentro del Día now, because the Encuentro del Día relates to Remco Evenepoel. Yesterday, I spoke to his coach, Kern Pilgrim, at a very noisy start. Where were we yesterday morning? Someone will have to help me. The day's
Sevilla?
All a blur. Sevilla. We were close to Sevilla. Aracena. That's where we were. I spoke to Kern Pilgrim, is his name, and he is the subject of today's
El Encuentro del Día. The meeting of the day.
Okay, I just wanted to ask you, first of all, how far do you go back with Remco?
Since the year before he came to the team. I think the first time we saw him was in 17, when he just started racing. And then our scout saw him in a race in Spain. And then he sent us, he sent him to the lab for testing. And that was the first time we got to know him.
Tell me about that first test.
Yeah, it was nice. It was like a young kid, just curious to see what everything was. The test was good, of course. I mean, he already had talent.
How good was it?
Oh, what's good, what's not, that you could immediately say, like, this is something, like, extraordinary that we've never seen before. I mean, like, in the lab we test, there have been many big talents already in the past. But back then he was only just racing for a month or something. But with that in mind, it was really good, yeah.
When people talk about what is extraordinary about Remco, I suppose the aerodynamic, the CDA is one thing. I mean, what are the other standout characteristics that he has?
Well, yeah, it's like if you want to be good in a Grand Tour, you need to be able to push a lot of watts per kilo. It's not just aerodynamics. I mean, otherwise he could not do what he does on steep climbs. So, like, the engine he has is big. You could see already also in San Sebastian how fast he went up to up that steep climb. You saw that again here.
So when you started making a plan for this Vuelta a España, I know he was at the hotel in Calpe or Denia for a long time, at the altitude hotel, but talk to me a bit about the plan. What did you think he needed to improve and needed to really focus on over those 2 months before the Vuelta?
Yeah, he needed to have like a very good base in order to be very stable, to be able to perform well for 3 weeks. And there were a few things we learned from, like in Tour of Norway, he was really good. But then 2 weeks later in Swiss, so 3 weeks later was already a bit less. I think there also the heat was a big problem for him. It was not very well adapted to the heat, and that was the first real heat of the season. They really suffered a lot. So that also made that we wanted to focus extra on that. So first, after doing the altitude in Livigno, like in the last part towards the Vuelta, yeah, we knew it didn't need much racing to be really good. That's what we saw in Norway. So we really wanted to focus on like training in the heat and getting used to these temperatures.
The big doubt was obviously the 3 weeks, and well, the journalist's big doubt was the 3 weeks. Did you have the same doubt?
For us, it was also a question mark. I mean, he never did it before. So yeah, of course, last year in the Giro was not a, that didn't went very well. He started really good, but it didn't last for long. But we also knew that that was a very different approach. But yeah, it was a question mark also for us.
It's gone well so far. Thanks, Ken.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast Team Car at the back of the pack, please.
Thank you very much to Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, of course. This is Lionel again, just to tell you about our clothing partnership with MAP. Not long to wait now before the Cycling Podcast collection is available. Should be available worldwide on September the 20th. And of course, that is including the Dot cycling jersey, which is inspired by the kind of late 80s cycling jersey design. It was the clear winner in our listener poll during the Tour de France, and it will be complemented with some matching bib shorts. There's also a casquette, a bidon, and some socks, and the whole collection will be available to buy from map.cc on September the 20th or thereabouts. Very much looking forward to getting hold of my jersey, hoping that it will turn up in time for my trip around Scotland, the northern half of our Tour de Cosse, visiting all of the Scottish Football League grounds on two wheels. That's Simon Gill and I setting off in a couple of weeks' time. And, well, I'll be taking a range of my MAP clothing, preparing for all weathers, really. So I'll be taking some of the thermal clothing as well, the thermal bib tights and the thermal jacket, because, well, you never know, late September in Scotland, the weather could throw absolutely anything at us. And if you go to map.cc, you'll see that they have clothing for all conditions. So check out the website and see what takes your fancy.
El ritmo de la vuelta. The rhythm of the Vuelta.
This is El Ritmo de la Vuelta, our daily excuse to fandango into the night, our pulses racing, shoulders shimmying, soul vibrating, medallions swinging, glow sticks bobbing, unzipped shirt flapping in the wind a la Iban Mayo circa the summer of 2003, as we reacquaint ourselves with the floor fillers and disco liquidators that have provided the official anthems of the Vuelta a España going back to 1978. I mentioned medallions there. That was inspired by Juan Ayuso. I didn't even mention the fact, and the listeners heard it, that I'd asked him about this huge medallion that he has swinging from his neck. He said it was gifted to him by his grandmother when he was born, and he's worn it ever since. So anyway, this is Ritmo de la Vuelta, and our medallions are swinging. ¿Quién le dio sentido a nuestro amor? No. Fui yo, fue nuestro corazón. Today, chaps, let's all meet up in the year 2000. Won't it be strange when we're all fully grown? Rob Hatch, where does that come from?
Sheffield. Pulp. I was there on my holidays last week.
More your kind of music than mine. Anyway, 2000. Why this edition? Well, I was thinking about the Cherry Link, and the best I could come up with was that in the year 2000, a rider called Cherry Tree, Francisco Cerezo of Vitalicio Seguros, briefly became famous or infamous for getting decked, literally punched, by the normally peace-loving Mario Cipollini. Cerezo's crime, having sworn at Cipollini twice for nothing, Cipollini was caught on camera saying. And while Cerezo sat on a curbside getting medical attention, a bloody bandage over his left eye, Chippo was duly kicked out of the Vuelta later that day. I actually spoke to Victor Hugo Peña this afternoon, who was Cerezo's teammate at Vitalicio Seguros in that Vuelta a España, and he confirmed that, Chippo had given him a right hook. 2000 Vuelta, the sky doesn't understand. El cielo no entiende. They were not the Lion King's words. They were not Cipollini's words upon leaving the Vuelta, but the name of that year's official song. It was sung by OBK, an electro-pop duo from Malaga and Barcelona, consisting of Miguel Arroña Arjona and Jordi Sanchez. They were united by their love of Depeche Mode, among other bands, and they were one of the most popular acts in Spain in the 1990s, several of their albums going platinum. The race to which they provided the soundtrack began in Malaga on the 26th of August with a time trial won by one of the favourites for overall victory, Alex Zula. Reigning world champion and yogurt fiend, see or listen to Saturday's episode for more on that. Oscar Freire won two stages in the first week, while the reigning Vuelta champion, Jan Ulrich, pulled out. Zula remained in the gold jersey until Abraham Alano took it off him in the second TT of the race in Tarragona. But Alano too would soon show his limitations in the mountains. The key stage, as had often been the case since the climb's premiere in 1983, went to the Lagos de Covadonga. Rob Hatch went to the Lagos de Covadonga a few days ago. More on that in a second. The 26-year-old Heras was the winner of that stage, and Heras was also the champion-elect. He won again on the Alto de Avantos, that's also in the Sierra de Guadarrama, as we talked about earlier, on the penultimate day to seal what would be the first of his four Vuelta titles. The last one in 2005 initially was struck off due to a positive test for EPO, only to be restored to him on appeal years later. Wow, that was long. Rob Hatch, Covadonga, how was it?
What a place. What a place. Lagos de Covadonga. Ridiculously green. Of course, changing my imagination of all that is Spain, given the fact that I've always either lived on the island or in the south. I don't really know northern Spain too well, apart from a few trips for work and things like that. But absolutely stunning up the top. In terms of the climb to get there, I'm glad I wasn't on my bike. Let's just put it that way, because it is absolutely horrible.
I have. But you know what's the worst part about Lagos de Covadonga is, like, there's this downhill.
Pronouncing it. One of your mates, Ian Boswell, calls it the Lagos of Cowabunga. But anyway.
That's funny.
You were saying, yeah, Larry, sorry.
Yeah, one of the worst parts about the climb is that, like, there's a downhill in the middle, you know, and it's maybe like a K long or something like that. Or it's near the top. All the buses have to park at the bottom of the climb. And so to go back to the buses, it's not like you just descend. You've done this huge climb, but you have to go back up this steep uphill that's at least a K long to get back down to the buses. And yeah, if I recall correctly, it was just this big fight to hang on to any motorbike you could to go back to, not in the race, but like after the race, to go back to the buses. Everyone was trying to like hang on to whatever they could to get up this, you know, 1K bump after the climb, because everyone was just dead from the rest of the day. But yeah, that's the thing I remember the most about the Lagos de Covadonga. Less the view.
Well, Larry, it's not all medallions, chest hair and glamour in the world tour, is it? Life is not always glamorous as a world tour professional. Today, chaps, well, we saw several crashes which illustrated that. One of them affected Jay Vine, actually put him out of the race. He was the King of the Mountains elect, double stage winner, of course, and well, we wish him well in his recovery. On the lack of glamour in professional cycling in the World Tour, we've already heard Jay Vine early in the World Tour talk about how, well, one of the nice things about his first stage win was the bonus that he was going to get. We spoke to him this morning in Trujillo about the significance for him of being King of the Mountains in the Vuelta a España, and here's what he said.
How much motivation is it when you're in that jersey, and what's the meaning of the mountains classification for you?
I think there's 13 grand on in the meaning, in the prize money. That's a start, but also, I mean, for the team, I think it'll be the first jersey we actually take home at the end of a Grand Tour, so it's pretty special for a pro continental team. I mean, considering the Tour de France, the yellow jersey has taken away the polka dots in the last 2 years, so maybe even 3 years. So, yeah, it's pretty special.
And as clarification, a lot of people don't know, how does that prize money get worked out? You say 13 grand, but it gets split among all the teammates, all the staff.
Well, 20% disappears straight away. Race organisers, the Spanish Federation, the anti-doping. So 20% disappears straight away. And then it's divided through taxes as well. I get taxed on it. And then finally it gets divided 9 ways. 8 ways with the riders, and then another way with the staff, because obviously we've got 20 odd staff here as well, so they deserve a bit of a cut as well. So that's how it gets divided up.
Jay, we love your honesty about money. You're the only guy who has ever spoken about it in here.
Oh, okay. Well, I've got to live somehow, don't I?
Exactly. Thomas De Gendt, for example, he's one guy who actually has spoken about it, and he says that it's a big motivation also to win money for the rest of the team. When he gets in breakaways, when he goes for sprint prizes, he's also thinking of that. Are you?
No, not thinking about like the prize money. That's a sort of a byproduct. I think that just comes with the sport. But I mean, yes, it's a big part of how we're able to do our jobs. Like, I had to actually pay to do my sport in Australia. Now I don't. So pretty nice to be able to do that. And also have a life outside of cycling, because at the end of the day, at the end of this Vuelta, I'm not going to be watching a bike race for a good long while. So I want to be able to do something else with my life, you know, and life isn't free.
So, chaps, that was Jay Vine this morning talking about the intricacies of prize money and, well, that €13,000 bonus. I think it's €13,000. I haven't checked either, which may well now go to Richard Carapaz because he is in the King of the Mountains jersey tonight. Larry, prize money figure highly on your list of priorities when you go racing?
Yeah, pretty much not at all, unfortunately. It's funny because actually I was talking with a race car driver yesterday about prize, you know, we were talking about our different sports, and he asked about prize money, and I actually said, you know, that for the most part it's kind of a joke, because I mean, by the time it gets to you as a rider, it's like already been taxed, split a million ways, taxed again, and then maybe split again. So like, you know, say if the mountains jersey is €13,000, by the time it would get to Jay Vine, you know, after all everything, you know, maybe it'd be like, I don't even know if he'd see €500. It really reduces significantly. So, you know, it's like, if guys are winning Grand Tours, if you're on a team that's winning Grand Tours, winning a lot of stages, you know, I'm sure the guys on UAE, they're getting like a nice chunk of prize money. Like, actually, a significant amount. But I would say for the rest of us, it's really not very much. So I never count on prize money or, you know, expect to get much of it. And when we do get it at the end of the year, I'm just like, oh, that's a nice surprise. You know, like maybe you have a little extra spending money, but it's not like, it's a fraction.
This is a bit like when you get this royalty check for sort of the Romanian translation of a book you wrote 18 years ago, which I, you know, still nice. Happens. You know, I still get the checks for €1.23 every 6 months. That does, I suppose, shine a bit of a light on how unglamorous things can be in the World Tour at times. Larry, at this time of year, precisely that point of how difficult life can be in the sports top tier is brought home to, well, there's a certain tier, there's a certain category of rider, particularly at the Vuelta a España, who is staring down the barrel of a contractless winter, a winter or an autumn at least, during which they and their agents will have to find employment for next year. There are a lot of riders at this Vuelta a España who haven't got contracts currently for next year. Jan Bakelants was one, a Belgian colleague told me this afternoon. And, well, another one is Alessandro De Marchi of Israel Premier Tech, a former Vuelta stage winner. I spoke to Alessandro this morning about how he envisages the coming winter. And let's just hear a little bit of Alessandro in Italian, and I'll summarize afterwards.
Cambierò qualcosina nella preparazione, cercherò di aggiornarmi anch'io e di rimanere un po' al passo coi tempi. E tutto questo ovviamente viene dopo aver trovato un contratto, perché in questo momento siamo ancora alla ricerca di un posto e quindi Io sto già pensando all'inverno, però ovviamente devo prima sistemare questo dettaglio.
Well, that was De Marchi talking about, well, first of all, how he intends to sort of reinvent his training over the winter, seeing the likes of Pogacar, Evenepoel and lots of other young riders thrive has given him food for thought, and he's going to make some changes to his training. But he says the biggest priority at the moment is finding employment for next year. I also spoke to his agent, Raimondo Scimone, later in the afternoon, and he said there are a few options on the table, but well, including the possibility of renewing with Israel Premier Tech, but nothing concrete, nothing they can really hang their hat on at the moment. And Alessandro did talk about how unpleasant it is riding with that pressure, particularly at the Vuelta a España, knowing that, you know, your future could hinge on every break that you do or don't make. Larry, I believe you have had this experience as well at the Vuelta a España. Tell us about it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I had it actually a couple years. So actually, most of the times I did the Vuelta, I think I almost didn't have a contract signed for the next year. So it definitely weighs heavy on your shoulders, and it can be really stressful. The one thing is, I found that I dealt quite well with that stress, and I think it actually pushed me maybe to be a bit better. Not that I enjoyed it, but you know, I think it motivated me as a rider, just because you had so much on the line. And to be honest, it really surprises me that a guy like De Marchi would not have a contract yet, because like, at least for quite a number of years, I feel like he was a pretty sought after rider in terms of like a breakaway guy who can really convert those into wins. So maybe it's more of a sticking over the number on the contract than it is actually finding a contract. I don't know.
What I've heard a lot over the last couple of years, and I've heard from a few agents this year as well, is that, well, they talk about the kind of opportunity cost of taking a rider like De Marchi. They've had their heads turned. A lot of teams have had their heads turned by the success of these very young riders. And they would rather take a neo-pro or even a 19 or 20-year-old in some cases, less in expectation than in the hope that they could unearth a diamond. And I think that's where guys like De Marchi are suffering.
I can see that for, you know, a lot of guys. I just thought, you know, he's won quite a lot of races, so I wouldn't have assumed that would even be the case with him. But yeah, it's definitely crazy. You know, I've had friends who they've had like their best seasons ever, and if they're like 30 years old, it's really hard to find a contract. And you know, guys who win big races and stuff. So yeah, it's tough, but yeah, I guess that's just kind of what we're seeing now in the sport. And, you know, it's also evidenced when you look at the top five of the Vuelta, like there's a lot of really young guys in there. So I can see why teams are moving in that direction. But yeah, it's hard. So I definitely know what Alessandro's going through. I experienced that like quite a few times. But there's no better place to showcase yourself than at a grand tour like the Vuelta, which is, you know, you can see everywhere.
In those two cases, Larry, did your performances at the Vuelta end up helping?
Yeah, definitely. One year it was like, I was in the Vuelta, I was negotiating with one team, but then I had a really good performance at that Vuelta, and then it like led me to get a significantly better offer from the team that I was still with. And then, the year after, it didn't actually help. Now that I think about it, I had a really good performance in the Vuelta, and I was in a bunch of breakaways, and I had a few good results. And yeah, actually, now that I think about it, I actually didn't get a contract until that was like the year I went to Aqua Blue after. So 2016, I had a really good Vuelta. And in the end, it got me some interest.
That was when you were at IAM.
I was on IAM, yeah. And the team was folding at the end of the year, and it definitely led to, I had talks with quite a few teams after that Vuelta or during. One by one, they all kind of like slowly fell apart or fell through the cracks somehow. And then, it wasn't until even after Lombardia that year that I signed with Aqua Blue. So that one was actually really, really touch and go. So
was that paradoxically almost helpful that IAM was disbanding, was folding, because then there was an understanding for the fact that maybe the riders, who you were all in that position, or a lot of you were in that position, that you would not do your own thing, but you did have to think about yourself and your own future, rather than whatever
specific team goals you may have had?
Was at that Vuelta, we didn't really have like necessarily a big leader. So we were kind of going for stage wins anyway. So it didn't really make a big difference. But yeah, in the end, we won two stages at that Vuelta, one with Matthias Franck and another with Jonas Vangenechten. And we, you know, had a lot of other like really good, you know, like rides out of the breakaways and top tens and stuff. And I definitely think the worry of the team folding and guys, you know, not having jobs for the following year made everyone kind of step up a level. And, you know, it's even something I've seen, you know, I feel like with Movistar right now, it's not exactly the same because they're trying to save their own team. But, you know, that stress, that pressure of potentially losing their license, it's like Movistar is crushing it now, you know, on like in a lot of races. So, and you see that with actually a lot of these teams that are fighting relegation, it seems like a lot of them are like outperforming their normal selves because, yeah, there's just that pressure on them. So, while pressure can be really hard to deal with, I think sometimes it can, you know, lead to positive results.
Guys, just to flesh out that little chat about the youth and the change in dynamics, everybody's heads have been turned. Daniel, you know this, having all the sort of mailing lists of all the teams. Every email at the minute that seems to come through seems to be a link up with a cycling club, a link up with a development team. Teams are looking at this. And if you look at the current GC of the Vuelta, top seven, there's nobody older than 28. Lopez is 28, Mas is 27, Remco is 22 leading, and Juan Ayuso is still a teenager. Juan Ayuso is in a similar to position that Tadej Pogacar was in, albeit Pogacar was a year older when he had that brilliant well to finish third. He obviously won stages. Ayuso hasn't done that yet, but bear in mind he's a year younger. There has been a big, big change. And for Alessandro De Marchi, he's not had the best season of his career this year. But last year, let's not forget, he had a brilliant year, didn't he? He wore the pink jersey before that really unfortunate crash at the Giro d'Italia and then went on to win Tre Valli Varesine. So you'd suggest that there's still something left for the now 36-year-old from Friuli.
The marketplace is, well, the market is always very fickle, isn't it? And, you know, that was one of the frustrations of his agent today. As I said, I was speaking to Raimondo Scimone, Alessandro's agent, and he's got several riders whose seasons and whose last two seasons have been really badly affected by COVID. And Alessandro De Marchi's season has been badly affected by COVID. But there are other riders, and Matteo Fabbro is another one who Raimondo said has just not managed to. He hasn't just never found his best form again, having suffered COVID earlier in the year. And the timing of your good performances is key, you know, and the fact that, Larry, you're saying the Vuelta is very important, it illustrates that. This is the time, this is the window, particularly for those older riders, I think. You know, what I'm hearing from agents is that the teams are moving quickly to sign those long contracts with the very promising, very sought-after young riders, but they are willing to leave it a lot later for the post 30-year-olds. You know, then it's sort of September, October, and then, you know, with the recency bias of having just seen the Vuelta, the performances that will be foremost in their mind will be the ones riders are producing at this time of year, not what they did in March or February or in September of last year.
Science in Sport is supporting the cycling podcast at the 2022 Vuelta España. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for their long-term support of the cycling podcast. Everyone can get 25% off at scienceinsport.com with the discount code SISCP25. As we heard from Sam Brand earlier in today's episode, his golden rule for fueling was not to suddenly try something different on race day. And I think that's one thing that I've learned about fueling over the years, is to embed your fueling strategy in training. And then when you're doing your event, whether it's a sportive or a race, you're used to the types of energy food that you're eating, and you know how your body is going to respond to them. You don't want to suddenly switch something. Even changing flavour of gel can be a little bit disconcerting on race day. So train for your event, and that includes your fueling. That discount code again for Science in Sport is SISCP25.
etapa de mañana, la cena de ayer. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's food.
So, chaps, the cena de ayer, we were in Mérida. Who knows? Well, I'm not going to introduce our third guest of the night. Who? Rob Patch, have you ever been to Mérida?
I've never been to Mérida. I have been to where we're going to have to stage tomorrow. Talavera.
Mérida, home of Spain's best preserved Roman remains. There's an amphitheater, there are temples, there's a fantastic bridge. It was extremely beautiful and I would recommend a visit. But dinner last night, and how did I fare on the typical Extremaduran cuisine front? Not too bad. I had a salteado de bolletos y alcachofas for a starter. I'm going to introduce our last guest at this point because he's going to explain what that is. Fran Reyes, there'll be some wistful gazing in a minute, but in the meantime, could you just tell us about the salteado that I ate?
Okay, I will hold my wistfulness for a bit.
Yeah.
So, boletos are quite common here in Extremadura mushrooms,
yeah.
Exactly.
It's a particular type of mushroom.
Yeah, exactly. Extremadura is particularly well known because of their dehesas, which is a vast extension of flatlands on which pigs are around digging for mushrooms, and particularly boletus are some of the most appreciated by pigs and also by humans.
Yes, they were. They were very good. And alcachofas are artichokes. As discussed the other day, alcachofa is another word that comes from Arabic. Another of the legacies of the Muslims and the several hundred years that they spent in the south of Spain. I think Rob Hatch is going to present the stage that we've got coming tomorrow. It's an interesting one that starts and finishes in the same place. Rob Hatch, over to you.
Lots of words of Arabic origin in Spanish language. Before I get onto that, I'm going to leave you one of the most beautiful. Ojalá. I wish, I hope. And it comes from the Arabic inshallah or inshallah, which I'm not sure a lot of you are familiar with. So big part of the Spanish language, ojalá, coming from the Al-Andalus days. Yeah. Tomorrow, though, we go further north, away from Extremadura and Andalusia, and we're going into Castilla-La Mancha, the home of great Spanish stories. Talavera de la Reina is the start and finish town. It's a very, very short day. 138 kilometres, I think, something like that. 138.3 to be precise. Two big second category climbs, bonus seconds, and an intermediate sprint at the foot of the second ascension of the Puerto del Piélago. And then a big descent all the way into the finish. I'm not sure, Larry, what we might expect, but it's an interesting profile given the fact that it's loop stage up the same mountain twice. The first climb begins after just 11 kilometres, so could be an interesting day.
What's going to happen, Larry?
Yeah, I was going to say, well, definitely going to be an interesting day. You know, I'm feeling like it could be a Lawson-Craddock victory. You know, he's been pretty strong throughout this Vuelta. He was so strong the other day. And if he has any matches left, I think it's kind of the perfect stage for him because he showed he's strong on the climbs, but he's just not as light as some of the other guys. And he's, like, got a ton of power on the flat. So I think for a final like tomorrow, if he can get away, I don't think anyone could bring him back. I think it'll be pretty interesting to watch tomorrow, but I definitely think it's a good day for the break.
It's interesting, Larry. I spoke to Lawson Craddock again at the finish today because he really seemed exasperated yesterday. He seemed at a loss. He's tried this tactic several times of being in breaks, and not just in this year's Vuelta, but in Vueltas of yore, getting in breaks, realising that there are better climbers than him in those breaks, and trying to anticipate, trying to go early, and it hasn't worked thus far. And last night, after the finish, he seemed at the end of his tether. He seemed to think that he needed to try something different, try something new. So I asked him after the finish whether he'd done some soul searching last night and come up with a new method, basically. And he seemed to suggest that he hadn't. And I think it comes down to luck, doesn't it? It comes down to who you find yourself with in the break on any given day and how those riders are feeling on that day.
Yeah, I mean, I think tomorrow the interesting thing is the break will almost surely go on the climb because there's only 10K of flat before it starts to go uphill. So in contrast to a day that finishes on a climb and starts on a flat, this will be good for any big rider that can climb. So someone, he's not big, you know what I mean? Like a guy who's good on the flat and on the climbs, but not necessarily a pint-sized climber. So I don't know, I feel like a guy like Lawson's going to have the legs to get in the break, but I'll have the power to like distance guys on the flat. It'll just be, you know, I think it'll come down to like who's watching who, and if he can find a little gap to escape, I think he could hold on for the win.
Fred Wright also wants to win tomorrow, but he wants to win every day.
He's been in more breakaways than in the peloton, hasn't he?
He's been in a lot of breaks. I'm not sure he's been in as many as, what's the chap from Burgos Biache? Okamika.
No, he's the top of the standings when it comes to kilometers within the breakaway.
He also has the best name in the world. Chaps, I forgot to mention last night's wine was a Ribera del Guadiana. Not a wine I knew particularly well, but it's the top DO in Extremadura, a Tempranillo, a very deep, moody Fred wine. Jesus. The 3 weeks of the World Show is starting to get to me. It's a red wine, not a Fred wine, but maybe it will be a Fred wine. That's what we'll be toasting a Fred Wright victory with tomorrow. It's time for some wistful gazing. Before we do, I was thinking about your wistful reflections last night, Fran, because I was sitting in the square in Merida after our dinner last night enjoying a non-alcoholic beer, I should point out, after my dinner, watching the world go by, and there were quite a few people from the Vuelta there, one of whom was Roberto Laiseca, the Basque climber who won a stage in the Pyrenees in 2001 Vuelta a España, who I am told by our colleague Alistair Fotheringham in an interview once listed staring at the sea as one of his passions. Wistfully staring at the sea, and this made me think of you, Fran. Last night he looked like he was making a beeline for a shisha bar. We were sitting in, well, there were several bars in the square in Merida. One of them was a shisha bar, and Laiseca was certainly heading in that direction. Fran, what have you been wistfully gazing at today? Hopefully you've not been thinking about ex-girlfriends again, as you were yesterday.
Kind of.
Or is that every day?
Maybe. You know, you say Ander Okamika is the best name on the Vuelta a España.
Yeah.
The winner of the Vuelta a Talavera of this year, junior race that was held last week, his name is Estanislao Calabuch.
Wow.
He comes from the north of Catalonia, and he's going to make it as a pro. He has been one of the best juniors of the season. Call the name. It is going to be glorious when he makes it to the pro ranks.
That's the that's the opposite of wistful, looking into the future. Yeah. Well, looking into your crystal ball.
Okay, looking into the past, you know where we are today? This is the Valle del Jerte, the Jerte Valley. And
don't talk about cherries, we've already done that.
Well, I have to speak a bit about cherries, because one of the trips that my girlfriend always wanted it was to come here and see the blossoming of the cherry trees on Mount Papril. Yeah. I always failed to do that because I was engaged on some bike race, you know? And when we stopped the relationship, there wasn't a possibility anymore to make that dream come true. So, you know, we have to do it in another life.
Fran, it's a modern-day tragedy, and today was a triumph for Remco Evenepoel. I think that's an appropriate moment at which to end this evening's entertainment, if you can call it entertainment. I'm going to thank Larry Warbass. Larry, this is not your last appearance on the podcast this year. We're going to have you back at the weekend to wrap things up. Rob Hatch, you might join us again as well, if we can tie you down at some point. We've got, I'm not sure who else we've got the weekend. I think Brian Nygaard might be coming back. Oh, we've got Nico Van Looy tomorrow, Spanish journalist, and we'll have Fran back for more nostalgic ruminations, no doubt involving ex-girlfriends, maybe current girlfriends, I don't know. Fran, it's been a joy as always.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, guys. And, well, listeners, you'll hear from me again tomorrow.
Thanks, everyone.
Adios.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.